Hello everyone, welcome to the Laura Horn Art Podcast. Thank you so much for being here. This week, the Redefining Success series continues. My guest is Helen Hallows, a mixed media artist based in the UK. Helen has a deep love of nature, and it really shows in the way that she uses paint, collage, and stitch to capture the essence and mood of a place. In this episode, Helen talks about building creative confidence, using sketchbooks as process books, and becoming a more business-minded artist. There are many threads and themes in this conversation, but one thing that stands out is the importance of valuing yourself, not just your work, but also your wisdom and well-being. I hope you enjoy the episode, and I'd love to hear what your takeaways are from the conversation. Let us know in a message, comment, or over on Instagram stories. You can find Helen on Instagram at @Helen_Hallows_studio and me over at Laura Horn Art. So with that said, let's get straight into today's interview. Firstly, I just wanted to say a big thank you for joining me today. I've been so looking forward to this chat. When I went over and had a look at your Instagram page and your website, I was actually with my daughter who's 13. We instantly both just went, yes, and we fell in love with you.
Oh, bless you. Thank you. That's made me feel all warm inside.
Yeah. And we just, well, you know, it's funny you say that because we felt so warm and fuzzy looking at your art and your studio and how you interpret nature and bring it into the work that you create. We both looked at each other and went, oh, you've got to interview. You've got to do this interview.
So I wanted I'm glad it's all working.
Yeah. So I wanted to share that with you. I mentioned to you when we were having sort of emails back and forth that I like to do a bit of a background before we get into the questions. So I'd love if you could tell me how you got started with making art.
I don't think there was a start date. I think I was born making art. And obviously there was a period when I probably wasn't quite capable of it, but I remember making art as far back as possible and art being supported by my family. One of my kind of early art making was with my mum doing footprints on the wall. And so obviously that was, you know, implemented by her. And I was always drawing. I was always illustrating stories that I wrote. I wanted to be an illustrator from quite a young age. It was just what I did. I made things. I sewed from quite an early age. And it just, I always had something on the go. And I loved pencils, paints, you know, any of that that anybody gave me was just the best thing ever. But, you know, getting into it formally, I suppose I was good at it at school, but I didn't find it particularly stimulating at school. And I was academic at school. So when it got to kind of choosing subjects, I dropped art and then went back to it. I had a friend who went on to study art and I was like, that's what I want to do. And it was a big turning point to turn away from the academic and turn away from family expectations by that point as well. But I'm from a creative family. It just was part of me. So my formal art education then was doing a foundation studies course, which I kind of did a range of everything and then specialised in textiles at the end of that, before going on to do a university degree in woven textiles, which had a kind of unspecialised first year and then a specialised second and third year. So that was what I graduated with as a textiles degree at a stage actually when a lot of the textiles industry in the UK was closing. It was kind of, and retrospectively, I'm not sure it was the right route through, but I guess we all take wiggly routes through that. The degree that you do isn't always what you end up doing, though mine's quite closely aligned actually. But I know lots of sculptors who've become illustrators and, you know, taken quite wiggly routes. And I think sometimes when you talk to people about your art background, people always think that you kind of had to do something very linear. I don't think creativity always works like that.
It's interesting that you say that because in the interviews that I've done over the last few weeks, I can barely think of anyone who had a linear route. Like there's been so many stories similar to yours about sort of going in one direction and then that kind of eventually meandering another way and then being introduced to something else and it all culminating in what they're doing right now. How did you move from textiles into mixed media art?
Well, I think my textiles was always a bit mixed media anyway. Certainly my research work for my finished pieces of textiles was tended towards multimedia. And I'd nearly picked multimedia textiles as an option. And my confidence in my drawing wasn't very strong at university. There was more confidence in sort of the output in the woven textiles. And that's because I wasn't particularly a confident image maker at that stage. I'm just reflecting here on my kids who are kind of going through that stage now where they're not confident image makers. You sort of just draw naturally as a kid, and then at some point you feel you have to be a certain way. And I was still kind of had that overhang from that. And so I wasn't a very confident image maker whilst I was on my degree. But by the end of it, I'd done a project where I had done a lot more drawing and building. It was about buildings, and I was layering sheets into my sketchbook. The project was kind of a national design project, and I'd done some work kind of designing textiles for the interior of a gallery. And the gallery had lots of layers looking through, and I started to kind of manipulate my sketchbook so that it had layers looking through. I used tracing paper and I used different media to kind of represent the concepts of that. That was a real leaping off point for me. And so when I graduated, I moved to London, and I had my sort of a retail job to get going. And then I started working doing textiles with a textile agent. My portfolio I'd left university with was mainly weave-based, but it had lots of elements of different things. And even with the weave, I was starting to manipulate it. And I never kind of was happy to just stop where sort of at the edges of something. I've always liked adding bits on, taking things away. And so my work with my textile agent was mainly embroidered work. I think I'd realized that I could, you know, have much more scope doing that. It was a time when embroidered textiles had become possible through kind of on industrial machines, and there were lots of embroidered clothes, embroidery and applique on bedding. There was a kind of key stage when that became possible. And I sold handmade samples to industry through my agent. And that was just wonderful because I was making things by hand, which I love, working on a range of textile projects and stationery projects. You know, there was breadth in there. But there was a point at which, I graduated in 97. So sort of I'd got established into that couple of years, but suddenly everything was Photoshop this and files that, and it stopped being just a pure textile process and had to become a design process, which was print ready for industry. And I didn't have those skills. So I was kind of playing catch up. And whilst I was doing that, I stopped working with fabrics and started working with papers, purely so that those designs could be scanned and sent to a customer, whereas fabrics didn't scan so well. So it was a practical point of change in how the industry was working. And for me, it then meant I sort of started to let go of working with paper with fabrics. I started to let go of working with fabrics and started working with papers, and found loads of scope in that because I could use vintage papers, collected papers. I could make my own papers. So the work was still created in the same way, in that I was cutting pieces and layering them, stitching them together. I stitched on paper, but I'd stepped away from the fabric. And just in doing that, it sort of changed how I was working. And then I'd moved away from London to have my family. I was juggling doing textile design work with my family and my textile agent. It was the recession and her business wasn't going so well. And so I stopped working with her. I was really lost, actually, because I'd been working with her for about 7 years. I just had a new young family. I didn't really know how to focus my creativity. So I started doing some work for myself and some textile work for myself. And the pieces I was doing to develop that textile work, which it was still weave and tapestry based, but the pieces I was doing to develop that work were mixed media, because I think they were done on the hop. I didn't have much time whilst my kids were really small. I would just put sketches together with bits of paper I had around and kind of draw onto them, add a bit of paint. And those became something in their own right. And they became pieces which I felt had commercial scope because they weren't as time consuming as doing these huge pieces of textiles. And I kind of just still felt lost at that point because as you do when you're going through a change and you're trying something new, you're not really sure how you're going to get it out into the world. But I entered one of those pieces into an open exhibition, and the gallery were really liked it and asked me to do a few more for their gallery. And it just started. And it's funny when you look back at your kind of career path and how your creativity has ebbed and flowed. I think when you hop on and look at the website, somebody's established, you just feel that they've always done it that way and it's always gone well. And actually that point was really quite troublesome and I felt very lost. But then the world found me, or I found the world, and I started to sell landscapes that I created in this mixed media way that I've become known for.
So can you describe your landscapes a little bit more, like what kind of substrate, materials, so that we can get a bit of a picture of the work that came through from that experimentation?
Yeah, sure. So I work on paper background, I work on watercolour paper. The reason I work on watercolour paper is because it holds the paint very well, but also when I get to the stage of stitching onto it, it doesn't fall apart as some sort of more thinner papers would. And watercolour paper's got quite a lot of density to it and a kind of cloth feel to it. It's got fibres in it which stop it falling apart. And so I work on stretch paper and I paint onto that with a kind of loose shape-based landscape. And I'll block that out in colour, but then I collage into that. And the collage pieces are pieces of paper that I have created paint, texture, pattern on in the studio. And I piece those together like a patchwork, I guess, to give the textures and essence of the landscape. They're colourful and I want the colour to be about expressing mood and a sense of place. And once all those collage pieces are in place, they're glued down. And then I use stitch to kind of bond those layers. The stitch is almost like it's a drawn line at the end and it holds everything together. And as I'm progressing with those pieces, as time's moving on, my work's becoming more abstract and more about that sense of a place and that sense of a mood and a season that, you know, we're constantly moving with the pulse of nature and trying to represent that connection to nature. So they're kind of getting looser as I go. And the focus is becoming more on perhaps those stories of nature. And I've got birds appearing in the work. There's a bit more focus on trees this year. Just the energy that nature gives me, you know, the seasonal shifts that I feel with when I connect to nature.
That sounds like a beautiful process with so many different elements to it. Do you work on one piece at a time, or do you have sessions where you work on multiples and perhaps dive into loads of stitching or loads of collage work? How do you move through your pieces?
I do work in series, and I think that goes back to being a textile designer when I would work in collections of sort of 8 or 10 designs for an agent. And I find that I can get out of my head a bit more when I'm working in series and let the work evolve. Because if you're doing one, you can kind of end up just pouring too much into it and get that sense of it being overworked or overthought. So working in series, I might work on a day piece and a night piece, or I might work on a couple of summer pieces together. And that would be mainly at those initial stages that when I'm planning out work and getting the colour down, getting the paint down. It's also, yeah, at different stages, like the collage stage, I tend to work quite slowly at that stage. And there's a lot of working out whether the colour values are right. So stepping away from it, coming back to it, seeing what colours are receding, what are coming forth. And so that's intuitive to me, but it's knowledge based. And it's important to make sure that when somebody looks at the image, there's not something really jarring that jumps out or sinks, recedes too far into the page. So that's quite a sort of a slow space. And then at the time they're done like that, yeah, I'll probably have some time stitching them all to finish them all. That's kind of that last bit. But I don't kind of chunk it in. Now I'm going to do all the backgrounds. Now I'm going to do all the collage. Now I'm going to do all the stitch. I work intuitively with it. And a piece can sit there for a while from that sort of offset point of painting it before I'll then collage it. But, you know, a deadline's a wonderful thing. And if I've got a collection to do for a gallery or an exhibition, or I've decided to do a new set of cards or whatever, I think a bit of a push really helps you to move that creative flow along. So, yeah, I'll work in series because that's effective for getting things done for a deadline as well.
I wanted to ask you what it felt like to transition away from working with an agent. So when you started doing stuff for yourself, how did that feel and what are some of the differences?
I was a bit terrified because I lost my work with her round about when my son was one. So I wasn't particularly creatively focused, and then I felt I needed to establish something new for myself and a new income for myself. And then I kind of floundered for quite a while, and I had my second son. So I wasn't sort of sparking off creatively. And I suppose it's that, isn't it? An agent sets you boundaries and projects, they have deadlines. When you start to work for yourself, you're not really sure what your boundaries are or where even the outlet is going to be for your work. I suppose having worked on stationery projects as well as textiles projects, I was aware that, you know, there was that industry I could get into or I could self-publish. But I really just went into it from a creative point of view, that I needed to feed my creative soul at a time when my children were taking up a lot of energy and I felt I'd lost a bit of myself. And I didn't really think, I suppose because I was in that point of having young children, I didn't feel as much pressure to earn at that stage. So I had a little bit of a time of evolution. I didn't feel confident about my own work at that stage. I couldn't see the value in it. And it was only really with starting to work with a gallery and then putting just one foot in front of another, doing some handmade cards for the gallery in a sort of similar style, just one thing after another, and it slowly built. And retrospectively, it obviously went in the right direction because here I am today. But at the time, I didn't know what I was doing. And so I floundered for quite a while. And I suppose retrospectively, if I could tell myself it's all going to be all right and have a bit of confidence, I could have probably got there quicker. But I was sort of evolving children and artwork at the same time, and they both needed energy.
You found the process of developing your style and figuring out how to get your art out into the world pretty scary. You mentioned floundering for quite a while, but then you had a show where you began showing your work in a gallery. What happened from there once you started getting your work out and seen?
I think the minute I had a sale, I felt $1 million. There's something about somebody else validating who you are, wanting your artwork, which is just, it's not about the money. It's about them seeing the value in it. It's about them seeing the beauty in it and seeing what you're trying to express, that is just wonderfully, wonderfully fulfilling and a bit of a drug, actually. It's just that it's a real high. Building on that gave me confidence. And after that initial feedback from the gallery and them wanting some work, I did feel more confident and approached some other galleries to just, you know, have a few pieces of my work. I started doing art fairs as well. So where I live in the Midlands in the UK, we have some wonderful art fairs which are hosted in kind of small villages, and people open their homes and you hang your work in their home, and then the visitors do kind of, they get an art trail, they get a garden trail, they get a snoop in people's lovely houses. And there's a real camaraderie between all the creatives who do that and the people who host that. And I've been doing events like that for a number of years, as well as kind of more market-based art events. That was a good way for me of being able to see what people liked when I was selling that work, because you meet your public face-to-face, whereas in a gallery, you're not there when those sales get made, so you just get it as feedback. And it also gave me connection to a creative community as well, because you start to see the same faces, the same people selling the work, and some of those people are ahead of you on that journey and can give you advice and connections. I did that for a number of years, really. I'm trying to get a timescale on this. I mean, I've been working in this way for about 12 years. And so, you know, 10 years ago, I was still quite tentatively doing events. And then it's 10 years as well since I started teaching. So a gallery would ask me then to do a workshop to go alongside the work that had there. And I started sharing my work in that way. So it evolved step by step, and every stage was scary. Every stage was terrifying.
So at what point did you start seeing your art as a business or something that you needed to have a financial mindset with?
I'm stubborn, and I knew when I had small children that I needed to create to feel whole and to be me and to be able to be a good me for them. I suppose for a while, whilst they were small and the business was growing, it was always extra money on for our family income. And I was driven by the love of creating, not the love of money. And I think my mindset has been not business-based at all, really, until probably about 3 years ago. And I actually had I won't say it was a full breakdown, but I had health issues, which then caused depression. I found that I questioned whether I should be doing my art. I questioned what I was getting from it. And I had to really question how I valued it and how I was going to treat it going forward. And at that point, I think I had a big mindset shift to needing to look after myself in the midst of everything I was doing, needing to value what I was doing so that it gave an income that was commensurate with the effort that I was putting in. Because I was getting older, you know, I'd hit my mid-40s, and you start to need some security and need to be able to provide growing kids with things which, you know, the world expects you to. And I needed to go through that mindset shift. And at that point, I really nearly just pulled back and went, no, I'm not going to do it. But that stubborn bit of me just keeps creating. And it's all I know. It's all I've known really for my whole working life. So I now have a coach. I now have a business network, and I do treat it as a business. And that's been hugely helpful, both for my own security, personal growth, and creativity, actually.
That's interesting that you say that the shift has been helpful for both you and your spiritual growth and also your creativity, and I imagine financially as well. So to be able to focus on the business but also realize that business growth can be healthy for you, because what I'm thinking is sometimes we almost feel guilty for focusing on that side of art, even though it is our livelihood. Have you ever felt that way?
Yes, and I think there's a societal attitude that you create art because you love art, that artists don't need to be remunerated, that somehow there's this image of the poor artist. You know, we've got Van Gogh, who never made any money off his art in his life, as kind of our role model. I think as a creative soul as well, I'm driven by that creativity. But so there is a bit of a guilt attachment, and people are buying it because they love the beauty of it. And you don't want it to be a transaction that's just kind of about cash. But it is my job and it is my livelihood, and I do love it. And yes, I'm very lucky to do a job I love. You have to value yourself as well. And I think, you know, going back to that, the choices you make along the way with your studies and your career, you know, my choice was presented to me as, if you do art, you're not going to be very well off. And if you do textile engineering, which is what I was down to do, then that gives you a career and an income. So right from the start, you're kind of made to feel that you've sort of made the wrong choice in some way, and that income's not available to you. And yet we're surrounded by design, we're surrounded by art, we're surrounded by, you know, the industry around that, the card industry, the surface pattern industry. There is scope to have a career within that. I now, value, I think, what I do more, because whilst you're feeling that maybe, you know, you should be supporting your family in a different way, maybe you should be getting the proper job, maybe you've just not quite grown up enough yet to go and do that, then you don't value what you do. But now I understand my level of expertise in what I do, both in creating it, teaching it, and sharing it. I'm a complete advocate for creativity, and I am really passionate about sharing that with, you know, my followers and my tribe. You know, I found my people through what I do, and now that's really given me energy to carry on doing it, because you have to have that energy, because it's a busy life working for yourself, because you need to make sure that you can garner that income and keep the energy to do all the things I do, you know, keep all those plates in the air.
So what were some of the biggest shifts that you made after you went through that challenging time when you were questioning everything? But you mentioned that you were stubborn and you had to keep creating. So what are some of the changes that you made in order to nurture both your creativity but also your business?
That's an interesting one, because it was 2019. So when I went through the shift, I was just coming out of it, just kind of reconnecting and recommitting to who I was and who I wanted to be when I grow up. And then the COVID year hit. So my shift had this backdrop of having certain choices and commitments taken away. And I think I had just got back my energy. And so actually that gave me the vumph to go, right, I can still do this and I'm going to carry on whatever this world, this universe has thrown at me. So my mindset shift really coincided with the start of COVID lockdown just over a year ago. And I had to then create with focus because the galleries had closed and shops that sold my work were closed. The art events that I had booked were cancelled. My workshops that I was going to be teaching in person, I had to cancel. So actually in March last year, I just thought, I don't know how to take this forward. And I was quite afraid that I would just lose all my income. But I had dabbled in running online courses about 18 months before that. And I thought, right, I've got the scope to do that now. And actually taking off some of those commitments to all those different things meant I was able to juggle one big plate rather than all the little ones. And that created focus for me. And sometimes I think choice and freedom is a funny thing, isn't it? You can do so much and you end up doing so many things in a small way that actually it was good to be able to just have some focused time to concentrate on one project, which I had, you know, previously had as an extra thing and was able to make it into the main thing.
So did you use that time then to almost solely focus on creating online classes?
I did, yeah. I had live ones booked. And I thought, right, I'm going to get these online. And so they were quite raw because I did them quite quickly. And then we had such a good response to those from my tribe. And then that sort of started to extend out that I realized that I should use this time when we were at home. And also, you know, my husband was at home and husbands are quite useful at doing extra things for supporting creating online courses. I didn't have school runs and all of those things. So yeah, my focus became solely around the courses. And, you know, I'm a born planner. And so I actually really loved putting those together and getting the response that I got from them. I found that really creative, actually. And again, you know, just talking about business and valuing business, you know, running a business needs creativity. You need to come up with new ideas. You need to try different things and be prepared to shift. And I think a creative mindset is really helpful. So running a business creatively and running a creative business, you know, they go hand in hand, and putting an online course together, I really relish all the challenges that has thrown up and responding to those to create a product.
So you've created quite a lot of courses over the last year or so, but now things are starting to open back up. And I'm curious whether or not your approach to your art business is going to change, or whether you're going to go back to running in-person workshops and doing all the different things that you were doing, retail shops, exhibitions, those sorts of things, or are you going to focus on fewer things?
I'm definitely going to focus on fewer things. Firstly, it's been successful to spend that time and find a new tribe. And I think people are so much more open as well to doing things online after this year that we've had. We've all had to come to terms with the Zoom call and logging into things and finding that there's so much available and the pleasure in being able to, you know, feed your creative soul. I also found that, you know, retrospectively, I was spinning too many plates. And so it is still all about having that time to be creative. And so the simplified model of creating online courses and creating for the online courses, you know, the work that I can create in the studio in order to teach from and show people, that is actually giving me more creative time in really than it was doing different events, different workshops, going out to workshops on a regular basis and taking all your stuff with you. And that was exhausting. And so I feel that I found a model that works for me at this life stage and with the skills that I've got and have developed over the years. So it's really lovely. I did make a commitment a couple of years ago to doing more. I kind of felt it was raw artwork. I just wanted to get back to creating from, I've just put my hand on my stomach because it's creating from that internal space. And I wanted to get something new out of me. And instead of that kind of being on that treadmill, I've got that exhibition to do, or I need to do a collection of four of those for that kind of project. doing the courses has enabled that. It's enabled me more of what that sense of true creativity, which if I can just get this balance right, because I think this last year I did throw myself in at the deep end. And as I say, I've worked with a coach and just kind of just got really excited about it and put lots of energy into it. And now that we're starting to get back into the real world and busy weekends and, you know, different family things going on, I'm trying to just reassert the balance. But I feel that that's where I'm going to stick at, is doing my work and teaching through online platforms. But if, you know, there'll be other opportunities that I won't say no to, because it's always nice to connect to people in the real world as well.
I really love the way that you have found a synergy between your own creative work. So preparing for the classes, doing all your own stuff, and then sharing it. The way that those two things are working really well for you together, like there's a harmony there, that's super inspiring, certainly to me as an online teacher as well, the way that it's really feeding your creative soul.
Yeah, and I don't think I expected that. I mean, initially the courses I was turning into online courses were ones I was running in real life. And then during, I think it was quite about Christmas time, I realized that I'd spent a lot of my energy in putting those courses together and the work of that, and put my creativity to one side. And I thought, no, I need to feed me first. So I started doing sort of daily practice, sketchbook work. And the food that came out of that for new courses, I could just, you know, you use the word synergy. It's very much that. And I think then it's very real, isn't it? I then people who are following can see the work I'm creating, and then they can see the course that relates to that. And you've got that channel then that people can connect to and see what they're hopping onto when they join you for a course.
I want to go back to something that you said at the beginning of this conversation about how you didn't have confidence in your drawing. And I know now that you have a passion for drawing and sketchbooks and share a lot of that in your online classes. How have you brought joy back into drawing in, you know, the last 10 years or so?
That's a good question. I think I learned to draw like me. Rather than going to art college, you learn a lot about other creatives, other artists. You sort of aspire to draw in a more this way or a more that way. And it was only when I started to draw like I did as a child that I found pleasure in that process. So the project, which was that transformatory project at the end of university about the layers in the gallery, and that was set in a village setting where you had all these little buildings, and I drew them flat on with flat roofs like I had as a child, and patchwork them together and layered them up. And so it was a drawing. It was based in place, but it wasn't a realistic drawing. And so the place that I teach from, the place that I reach with my drawing, is about drawing like you. And we're all strands of our experiences, and we can only ever expect to be ourselves. And so getting to that space where you can enjoy that process of putting marks down, of capturing something of what you draw, because all drawing is an editing process, you know, otherwise we take a photograph. So what is it that you notice in your landscape? What is it that you notice when you're out? You know, it'll be a moment that I think, I've got to capture that. I've got to capture that flock of birds that just flew out of that tree, and I'll get it down. And the other thing was, when my kids were small, I'd take a sketchbook out with me if we were on a holidays or family days. And of course, I had my hands full, and all of the energy was about getting to the next ice cream and that kind of thing. And the sketchbook would stay in my pocket. But when I got home, I would think, what was it that I noticed? And I'd hold that kind of snapshot in my head and then sketch it out in a very simple way. So using sketchbooks as process books, using them as spaces for ideas, takes away that pressure of what a drawing should be, into using it as a stepping stone to get to another drawing, another idea, an idea for a textile piece or a painting piece. So they're very much process books, and I've kept them for a long time. Over this last 10 years, I've found a lot more pleasure in using a sketchbook and in bringing colour into and texture and pattern into the sketchbook as an exploratory area before doing pieces beyond the sketchbook.
Do you have different kinds of sketchbooks for different things, or can you tell us a bit more about your sketchbook collection?
I have lots of sketchbooks now, which have accumulated over time. And that is another pleasure of the sketchbook, is that if you just keep going, you know, they build. I don't have different sketchbooks for different things. I'll work on a project in a sketchbook. So if I was going on my summer holiday, I would either make or buy a sketchbook specifically for that holiday, fill it up or half fill it up, and sometimes just a few pages get filled up, and that would be then completed. So I don't have like one sketchbook for landscapes, one sketchbook for my garden. I'll do a project around one or the other. And so I now make a lot of my own sketchbooks as well. I find a lot of pleasure in hand making a sketchbook. I like working with concertina sketchbooks, so I make those. Occasionally, you know, I've got some very big sketchbooks where I'll have done an extended project within the studio. But for going out and about, you need something you can carry that you're not too precious about. And so in making sketchbooks as well, I make one which might have 15 or 20 pages, and then I fill it and it's done. Whereas when you buy sketchbooks, you sort of feel compelled to just keep on keeping on keeping on for the sake of filling a sketchbook, when actually I just want to capture something like a holiday or a day out or an experience.
So you have a lot of experience with sketchbooks, but I do know that for some people they can be very intimidating. We did a podcast episode here on sketchbook anxiety, and it's one of our most listened to podcasts. So I'm curious if you have some tips for anyone who's listening who feels very apprehensive about starting a new sketchbook, the blank page, or feel like they can't draw at all, those sorts of messages going through their mind. What would you say to someone who wants to get started but just can't?
Absolutely. I hear you. You know, I talk about fear of the white page a lot, and I understand this sense of creative block, which just stops us because of the voices that we hold on to of where we feel that we failed or that we didn't achieve in a way that we wished to. I always prepare a sketchbook. I get past that white page by colouring them in, you know, painting into pages so that it becomes yours, it becomes full of texture and mark already, and you get rid of the white. And there's something I don't like about those neat white pages. I much prefer it when they're painted and coloured. And once they are, pages kind of welcome you to do a drawing, you know. And so I don't start at the beginning. I'll start in the middle somewhere, where a green page with good grey squishy bits on evokes a landscape already and makes me want to go and draw one on top of it. I think before you can even put a mark in the sketchbook, you need to get yourself into feeling that you are creative and that you have a right to be creative and give yourself permission to be creative. And I always say you have to kind of almost surprise the creative fairy inside you and go in sideways. So that might be that you listen to music. It might be that you create a really nice little welcoming space in on your kitchen table or in the corner of your studio. That you walk in nature before you'd expect to draw from nature, that you experience it and that you connect to it, that you can't just draw, that you have to feed your soul before you can draw, so that you can get past some of that block and be more open to it. And then, you know, I teach with a lot of techniques about taking a line for a walk, about drawing with shape and not line, about going in different ways, different techniques for creating what we would formally call a drawing, but actually is just a series of marks, of shapes, of patterns. And I suppose that comes from my textile background of breaking things down in that way. And you find your flow that way, because then you'll do a shape-based drawing, and then from those shapes, you'll create a pattern repeat. From that, you might chop that up and then place it around a line drawing, and different ways of then evolving a sketchbook, so that then you start to spark off from that. So a task I might show in a lesson is the one that you go, I want to do 10 of those. And suddenly you've got that flow, and it's finding that flow, and sketchbooks are great for that. Once you get past that abject fear of starting.
They're such good tips. And I really love the way you described coming in sideways. That phrase is brilliant. Like, not starting at the beginning, just coming in from any angle.
Yeah, coming in sideways. So whether that is baking a cake, whether it's wearing a red scarf and red lipstick, whether it's, you know, going for a barefoot walk, it's jolting us out of all this kind of linear expectation of contemporary society into a space where you can evolve and be and find who you are and what you want to create. Because although we've all gone through that system of, you know, being taught art in school, we have to evolve with it. You can't just build it out of building blocks. It's something much more. I envisage it as a spiral, you know, where you have to lean into it and go with the flow and then come back a bit and then carry on. And it kind of goes against how we're taught to think and be and learn, but it has to be something much more fluid.
You mentioned a whole lot of different ways that you could come in sideways and how important it is to nurture your creative soul. What I wanted to ask you was, what are your favorite ways, like your personal ways of nurturing your creative soul? What do you like to do to stay healthy and feeling good about your creative practice?
I think it's so important to stay healthy. Whatever your passion in life is, you've got to be ready for it. I am someone who can be a bit boom and bust, so I have to be really aware that I'm expending a lot of energy with, I've just finished a new course and it's taken so much energy and I'm passionate about it and I want to do those hours and stay up late finishing it and all of that. But then you have to come back to your kind of back to base and calm and be gentle and trying to keep a routine with life. And actually I found after I had my kids, because they imposed a routine on me, in some ways that made me more steady as a creative. So I do yoga. I do a couple of yoga sessions a week, as well as a yoga nidra session, which is like a yoga sleep relaxation. And I find if I don't do that, I really know about it. I need that for that just time out and to zone out away from family as well. And of course, last year there's been this juggle of having family at home and work. So time out for me is really important. I love a hot bath. You know, if the world's all gone wrong, get in a hot bath. And I just love being in or near water. So we live near a canal and a river. And so I'll go and sit there for a bit and just refuel. Getting away from machines is really important. So much of how we communicate now and information we receive is through the screens. And so once I can get out the house and get away, my head sort of calms down. And I love to cook. And I do love doing textiles, which I do less of at the minute. I do like to, you know, knitting is very meditative, but I haven't done any for a while because I've just been doing a lot of other things. But now I'm talking about it, you remind yourself of all the things which just actually keep you calm. And you need headspace, I think, to be creative. So when I sit in the bath, I get my best ideas. I always have. And sort of pre-COVID, when everybody had their normal routines, I'd be quite happy to get in a bath at lunchtime and just let those ideas in. So whether that's going for a walk or just creating space where you get your thoughts can flow. But that said, if you're in a negative mindset, I don't think that's helpful. And I think so much of our creative life, we overthink. We've got so much scope now for receiving beautiful images through Pinterest or Instagram that kind of comparison really can kill the joy of creativity. And the same when we are making, that those voices in your head can really hold you back. And what we need to do is, again, that's what, just surprising your brain. I think that's where music can be really helpful when you're working. But I like to listen to classical music then, just so it drifts, so that I'm taken away and then letting that creativity flow through you. And when you get into that point, it's just bliss.
So do you have a routine for your studio practice at all? Do you do things on certain days, or is it all quite intuitive?
It's more intuitive than not, and it does shift a lot. I do have a plan. On Saturday morning, I will get studio catch-up time if I've not had any during the week. So that's sort of, that's known in family life that's what I'm doing and that's where I've gone. Because in some ways it's easier to create when it feels like the weekend rather than creating because it's your job. You know, it's creating that right sense of why you're doing it. It's just, that is me being me. So I have routines for other things, like when I do social media planning, when I do accounts. And if I don't plan those, then especially with accounts, it kind of just gets kicked down the road. So if I don't hold myself to account, you know, things like that don't get done. So those, the jobs of doing what I do get scheduled, and then I grab the other creative stuff. And something will take you off down a rabbit hole that you think, I'll just do 20 minutes. And then 3 hours later, you're like, oh, I better go and do the proper stuff.
So can you tell us a bit about your studio? You just said that on the weekends, that's where you'll be on Saturday morning, creating for yourself. Can you tell us what your setup is, how you like to organise your space, or anything about where you make art?
I now have a purpose-built studio at the bottom of our garden. I did rent a studio, but found that with family life, I just couldn't always get there when I wanted to. So we built a studio in the garden about 7 or 8 years ago, and it's 20 foot by 10 foot. So what's that? About 5 or 6 meters by 4 meters, glazed down one side, and it's my sanctuary. It's far enough away from the house that I can get my own headspace here. And at one point, I did share it with my husband, and I've slowly eked him out, poor man. He's now got a little studio in our house. I feel I need to shut the door and go inwards in order to be creative. So down the sides, on one side, I have a huge kitchen work surface, and it really helps to have one continuous surface because I tend to use that for creating work for filming, and it's really helpful to have things not falling off the end of a table. And then one end is officey and all the kind of files of workshop things. And one end is my creative space, where I feel that that is just where I do things for me. There's also a storage bit for products that I send out, for cards, for prints, for books. And in one corner, I've got artwork that's back from galleries in frames leaning up. So when I say all that, it sounds like it's a mansion, but it's a small, well-used, well-thought-through space. And that's evolved over time. I probably about once a year, I have a huge clear out and think, where did all this stuff come from? And rehome things. We've got a local art center. They get given things that I no longer need. And I have fabrics in here because I love fabrics. And I've recently put a chair in here, which is the idea that I'll sit down and pick up a magazine, but it doesn't happen much, but the cat will join me and sit on the chair. So I've learned over time what the space needs to be. And it does evolve. And at the minute, I'm finding that it's the best it has been. But I think I've had to be quite ruthless to get rid of things as well, so that it can be what it needs to be for creating and filming and sending things out. And of course, I'd like three spaces like this. I could have, you know, a whole house that could be just a studio, maybe one day.
Yeah, because I'm thinking if you've got those three main zones, that's quite a lot to fit into. Not a huge space, like it's a good sized studio, but as you mentioned, you could have, you know, a house with a room for each of those. So you have to make decisions about what to keep and how to best arrange things in order to be able to, I guess, get the best use out of your studio.
Yeah, and it's never tidy, but I will, you know, clear up a zone if I know that I've got lots to do in that area, and then move things aside. I'm always moving the pieces, but it's still, you know, it's got enough functionality that I'm very grateful to have it as my own designated space. So the other studios can wait. I'll stick with this one for now.
It looks absolutely lovely. I'll link some photos in the show notes for this episode so that everyone can take a look at your studio and your artwork and find out more about your online classes as well, because they look absolutely brilliant. But now I wanted to talk a little bit more about social media. You touched on it and said that you spend some time planning your social media posts. I wanted to find out a bit more about your approach to social media.
I really enjoy some of social media. I think since starting off on Instagram, that has been, because it's such a visual platform, I really enjoy both using Instagram and sharing on Instagram. And I think for mostly my social media posts are about me tracking what I do. There's some of telling other people about products, whether that's a course or artwork that I sell, but it's about sharing. It's about that tribe. You know, my relationship with the people who follow me is one where I think of them as friends who are interested in what I'm doing. And I like to share about my studio life. And as a point of reflection for me, I can go back through it and realize what I am doing and what I am achieving and how I have developed. So I quite like the fact that I can log back into that and see that story unfolding.
And how do you deal with the comparison side of social media? do you to have regular breaks, or what works well for you?
With social media, I've kind of backed off a bit from doing the whole Facebook thing. I think that's because I found there was a lot of negativity. But on Instagram, I find that there's just it's a visual feast. But I've reached a stage where I am secure in who I am and what I create. So I can look at somebody else doing something very beautiful and very successfully, but I know that's great. That's brilliant for them. It's not me. I'm me and they're them. So there's, of course, sometimes, you know, you feel a bit of a downer and you're like, oh, they've got it all their pieces lined up. But I know that that's not the truth of people's lives. I know that I share the best bits. I know that I share my best sketchbook pages and not the really rough ones. We've all got this sort of dual life now, haven't we? But mostly I find it a positive space, and that's why I enjoy sharing on it and using it. I think when you can kind of get lost down rabbit holes with Pinterest, where you start to just, you can absorb too much without doing. I get to a point where I go, right, stop looking, just go and do something, because you're not going to, it's like watching cookery programs, isn't it? And then eating your baked beans on toast. It's like, what are you watching it for? Why are you spending that time? It's got to inspire you to do something. And sometimes you have to say, right, enough, let's go and just do the do.
Yeah, I love it when you see, it's kind of ironic in a way, because you see them on social media, but posts like, you know, stop scrolling, go and make something, or stop consuming, start creating, those kind of messages. And whenever I see them, I'm like, oh, it kind of jolts me, because I'm in the middle of like scrolling through and looking things.
Yeah, it reminds you, doesn't it? And that's fine when you've just had 3 minutes of scrolling, but when you go, oh yes, they know I've been here an hour now.
It's funny, isn't it? During our conversation, quite a few times you've used the word tribe, that you've found your people, your tribe. What tips do you have for other artists that are looking to cultivate a tribe and, you know, you have, I guess, engagement with a smaller audience? So it doesn't necessarily need to be big, but they find their people.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I found my people through doing face-to-face selling, through doing art events, from doing live workshops. And I've got a really committed following and I love them. Because they've stood by me and they're growing as I grow. And I want the same from my online audience. I want people to be engaged and to be commenting. It's not a numbers game. It's about connection. And then people, when they connect to you, want the best for you and they want to share in what you're doing, which is, for me, it's the teaching at the minute. I think we get bogged down in these numbers and likes, and it is about finding the right people for you. You know, we are all unique and you need to find those people who want to value and share in your uniqueness. So being genuine, being who you are, being visible and truthful, I think attracts the right people to you.
That's such good advice, such wise words. And it made me think about something you said earlier, where you said that when you were scrolling through Instagram and Facebook, that it didn't really have an effect on you because you felt very secure in your own work. At what point did you feel that way? When did you know that this is the work that I'm going to create? There might be various iterations of it, but I have a strong sense of who I am and what I'm making.
Probably about 5 years ago. Why was that a turning point? I felt I'd got a body of work together that I was proud of, and I had products that related to that. I was teaching alongside that. And so again, it's that lining the pieces up, all going in the same direction. So it feels like this, I call it a bubble of me. It felt true to me. And yet there are wobbles. You know, my work's grown a lot in the last couple of years away from the framed landscapes, because I've been trying to find and evolve this new way of working, which is moving towards abstraction. And that's been tremendously wobbly. You know, I've had to really ask myself, is this who I am? Is this still a part of that conversation I'm having about nature? And of course it is, but I've had to talk to myself about that and look at how the work's evolving, because it's kind of evolved me. I haven't evolved it. It's found me. And then you have to find yourself within that conversation again. So we are always changing. And the challenge, I think, is to hold on to that as a joyful thing. I just find it fascinating sometimes if you just keep showing up at the page, what happens, how the work shifts without all of that overthinking and, oh, I've still got to sell this work in a frame. I've kind of allowed that creativity to happen to me rather than trying to control it.
Because one of the questions I was going to ask you, and I think we sort of covered it in our chat so far, but it was around how do you cultivate a style while also leaving room for growth and experimentation?
Yeah, that's a really good one. We can't just focus on the end point. And as a commercial artist who gets known for one thing, you feel that you have to keep producing that for your market and for the galleries. And that can be quite stifling. And so I think it's so important to have your own practice beyond your product where you can evolve. And hopefully those can evolve together far and above, you know, the selling. You've got to come back to this core of your own art practice, and that's showing up at the page and just doing the art. Because otherwise, I think you get stuck. And, you know, I see other artists and you can see that they're stuck because we need to make a living from what we do, but you also need to evolve your creativity because otherwise I think it becomes so unsatisfying. So yeah, turning up at the page for yourself on a regular basis, it's like meditation. You've got to do that for your own sanity and to allow for your own growth.
I absolutely love everything that you've said in this conversation. There's so many incredible tips, wisdom that you've gained over the last, well, your whole life. I want to finish with one last question, and I have been asking everyone in this season this question, and it is, what does success mean to you as an artist, and has it changed over the course of your creative life?
Yes, it has changed. I think when I was younger, success was about being creative, having a creative role, and I wasn't focused on what that translated to as an income. And then as I've got older, it's become more important for me for it to be remunerative, not because I love money more, just because I'm aware of my own frailty, I suppose, after having had some bouts of time needing time out from work and, you know, protecting myself for the future. So that sort of need for a bit of security. So I think that's just a grown-up brain. Now that I'm more established, I feel successful in knowing the value of the expertise I have, the resilience that I've had to keep going, the strength in reinventing myself. And it's about more than just my artwork. I value kind of the fullness of what I've been able to achieve, you know, with the technical skills and being able to talk to people passionately about being an advocate for art. And so the success is about becoming more confident, I think, in not just the art I produce, but in what I'm here to say and my sense of purpose.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that, Helen. And you mentioned quite a few times in this conversation about valuing your art and valuing your creative practice. And that's really come through in the way that you described what success means to you now. So thank you so much for sharing your story with us and providing all those wonderful tips and insights. I've loved every minute of this conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me. I've really enjoyed talking to you, Laura.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this week's episode. Such a rich and multi-layered conversation, a lot like Helen's art, which if you haven't seen, I definitely suggest that you head on over to her website, which is helenhallows.com, or over on Instagram, you'll find Helen at helen_hallows_studio. And if you'd like to follow me and my art journey, you can find me at laurahornart.com and over on Instagram at laurahornart. Have a wonderful week, everyone, and I hope that you'll join us next time for a brilliant and very practical episode featuring watercolour artist Leanna Fisher. I'll give you a heads up, if you're in the early stages of your art career and want some support and advice about setting up an online shop and creating multiple and passive income streams, make sure you are subscribed. You won't want to miss this one.